Good morning.
Good morning.
So yesterday we looked at the priestly document, chapter 1 of Genesis, and it's quite a beautiful, poetic, musical statement of the wonder of creation. And it came to a climax, as you know, in the God wanted to create human beings in God's own likeness. And then there's the blessing. It's not like one day, two day, three day, four. It's not like that. It's different aspects of creation. And the final is the blessing, God's blessing of human beings and the animal world. Every living creature received the blessing of God. And then there's the ongoing blessing of the Sabbath. We're called throughout our whole existence to rest with God, to be in communion with God. That's how the authors of Genesis saw what creation should be. And from God's hand, of course, it's all very good. And we're not allowed to forget that for the rest of the Bible, because that's the fundamental point. Creation is, so that's you, very good. This morning in the two sessions, a different group of people explore something else. They explore, well, why are we the way we are? With God's blessing, and we're made in God's image and likeness. But in fact, our life is more complex than that, and they do their best to analyze that. So in the story, Adam and Eve, basically, we're not sharing privileged information that gives us the names of the first human couple. It's not about two people, Adam and Eve. It's about man and woman, every man, every woman. It's about us. It's about humanity. It describes how they actually lived in paradise. It's not saying that. Before they sinned. There's no before and after here. It's not as if we used to be in a paradise where everything was just marvellous. Then we did something and then we fell to where we are. That's not the way it works. In fact, if you follow the evolutionary theory, which is the most probable theory we've got, it's surprising how good we are. I mean, we've come from animals that were pretty good, but not terribly what we're supposed to be. So rather than falling, we've actually evolved quite beautifully. So this isn't contradicting that. What we've got here is a reflection on what it means to be a human being, set in contrast to the myths of the ancient Near East, and from the perspective, the special perspective of the faith of Israel, that many generations have held this faith in Yahweh. And from that aspect, who are we? What is man? What is human being? We're offered a reflection on what life could be like if we only listen to God. We could be living in a paradise. And on some fundamental dimensions of sin and its terrible consequences for human life. The account no doubt reflects on legends of the patriarchs and on Israel's history, but it's a story which aims to help build a harmonious community in Judah after the exile, and to help, and on Israel's history, but it aims to help build a harmonious community in Judah by pointing out the kind of behavior that must be avoided to be faithful to the covenant and live the kind of life willed by God. The authors on this chapter 2 of Genesis says, we shall see, make no attempt to tell how evil came into the world. They don't surmise about that. It's totally mysterious. The talking serpent is a figure of fable. It's not the devil in disguise. Nor are they telling their readers the origin of death. Birth and death are obviously part of the organic, what it means to be alive. The text does say something about human folly, but as we should expect, the focus is on God and on God's response to our folly, which is very beautiful, as we'll see. We'll see how loving God's response is, a lesson the returned exiles needed to hear. They'd been through the exile, they'd been cast out of the garden, let's say. Now they've come back to Judah and the authors are trying to build a harmonious community there. The narrative reminded them, and it continues to remind us, that we're destined to live in God's world and in dependence on God. It insists that the Creator is their own Yahweh. So the Creator God, right at the beginnings, is Yahweh, as they see it. The one who hears the cry of the poor. Yahweh, as you know, comes from the burning bush and Moses, and God is singing, I've heard the cry of my people and I want to redeem them. That's Yahweh, the one who hears the cry of the poor and is always about redemption and liberation, etc. Well, that is the Creator, according to this text. The effects of our sin, and it's portrayed here as punishment, it's not punishment, of course, it's the effects of our sin. It's what we do when we sin to ourselves and to others. It can be corrective because of the mercy of God. But we cannot go on sinning without suffering sin's consequences. These chapters focus on the limits within which human beings must live. If they are going to build a faithful community in post-exilic Judah, they should live wisely, attentive to God's directions. If they do not, they're in danger of bringing upon themselves a repetition of the destruction of Jerusalem and the temple and the suffering of exile. They could be cast out again from the promised land. The correct question to ask ourselves as we read this material is not, what's the meaning of these past events for us today? That's not the correct question. The correct question is, what are the authors telling us about the human condition, about your life and my life? Though the material which we're about to read has links with myth, the authors are not interested in myth or in its cultic expression, which in the ancient Near East was mostly conceived as a tool for supporting the ruler, who was considered divine, and the state. Myth was there to keep the order established the way it is, as against any kind of change. The authors of Genesis are interested in history, yes, in human behaviour and responsible action. Here, formalised in a description of the human being as such. Let's not talk about gender yet, because they haven't talked about it yet. They will, but not yet. They're talking about humanity. And the various basic relationships within which we human beings live out our lives. They assert that we're inclined towards evil. They don't say why, they don't know why, they're not exploring that extraordinary dark mystery, but it's a fact. We are inclined towards evil, which is surprising, granted that we're created in God's likeness and we've been blessed by God and we're very good. So here's a dark problem, a shadow. But they reiterate their conviction that Yahweh is intimately involved in human history and that divine mercy, as has just been demonstrated in the return from the exile, transcends our sin. So we've got to know our sin but not look at it lest we implode in it. We have to look out at the wonder of creation, which we've done in chapter 1, and the wonder of God's blessing and God's mercy, so that we can somehow find our way out of the shade into what we're called to be. They speak of the paradox of being human, the dust and the spirit, the sanctity and the sin, the wonder and the limitations that we all experience. The meta-historical, so it's not history, it's alongside it on a parallel line. The meta-historical nature of the writings is highlighted by the fact that in these chapters there's no distinction between the sacred and the profane. There are no epiphanies. There are no theophanies. There is no revelation. There's no faith. All we've got in these chapters is the direct encounter with God. This is not history, it's story. It has something of the feel of once upon a time. I think that captures it really well. We say, once upon a time there lived, and we tell our story. Now, you could put here, beginning of Genesis, once upon a time, there was a garden, and then you're telling the story. And it's meant to fire the imagination, and of course it's a way, a powerful way, of communicating truth. Not historical fact, but truth. We have our origin in God, but the fact is that our communion is disturbed by our choices to go our own way without regard for God's will for us. The post-exilic authors were especially keen to inculcate a profound obedience to God's will, to the Torah, in the community gathered around the reconstructed temple. In these chapters, the authors are asking, what is God's design for the human race? Why are we the way we are? Why do we experience this radical ambivalence in our relationship to God? They're also reassuring the people that failure doesn't have to have the last word. God's gift is such that we can be restored to life after failure. Community can be restored. Thanks be to God. This is followed by chapter 4, in which they reflect that the disharmony that we humans experience, the pain, the sweated labour, the experience of the absence of God, the experience of suffering and guilt, and all the results of human disobedience and our failure to listen to the inspiration of God's Spirit. It will look at those. We will shortly. So it's time to start on the text. Sorry for that long introduction, but I feel it was necessary so that we're reading it once upon a time as a profoundly inspired insight into the way things actually are. Part one, that's chapter two, is a movement from wilderness to a world of fullness and communion. So we're doing the first half of it now and the second half later this morning. Well, here's the fact. Life needs rain from God, and God uses mankind as his instrument in ordering the earth. And now everything that you see in blue comes from the Yahwist, the text, the rest is commentary. And it begins when Yahweh God, so right here at the beginning, the priests never do that. They keep Yahweh for Moses and the book of Exodus, etc. But here, these authors put it in Yahweh. They want to relate God, the God of creation, to their God, Yahweh. Yahweh God made earth and the heavens. No plant of the field was yet on the earth, and no herb had yet sprung up, for Yahweh God had not caused it to rain upon the earth. And there was no human being to till the ground. No Adam to till the Adama, or to draw water from the earth, or to irrigate the whole surface of the ground. So they're going back right to the beginnings from a different aspect. Now the human being that God needs to create to water the earth, he's dust. We're dust. God's living and life-giving breath. So here's the two parts of us, as it were. And the text reads, then Yahweh God formed the human being, not from the ground, not from clay, not in this poetic image, but from the dust of the Adama. Dust. And when we are dust, but we're more than that. God breathed, Yahweh God breathed into his nostrils the breath of life. And the human being became a living being. All life comes from God. All life is from God's breath. So if we stop breathing in, if we stop receiving life, we die. But God keeps breathing into all the time, constantly breathing into us God's Spirit, God's life-giving Spirit. And here's some texts that reflect on that you know well. Job, remember that you moulded me, and in Job it's like clay, it's a different image. Will you now turn me to dust again? In Psalm 90, you return us back to dust, children of earth, back to earth. And Psalm 103, as a father has compassion for his children, so God has compassion for us who revere God. God does not fail to remember that we are but dust. Psalm 104, which I did earlier with you the night before last, I'll read a little bit of it again. All creatures look to you to give them their food in due season. When you provide it, they feed. When you open wide your hand, they have their fill. But when you hide your face, they are dismayed. And when you take away their breath, they die and return to dust. But you send forth your breath, and they're created, recreated, and you renew the face of the earth. All this imagery coming from our Genesis. Now we have the story of the garden. It's the Garden of Eden, which in the language of Ugarit means delight. So our story is coming from everywhere, but the Jewish authors are recreating it or reshaping it according to their faith. The word paradise, too, is a Persian word, picked up in exile, no doubt. And it's a word for an orchard, a garden with a wall around it and fountains in it. And you've seen plenty of this, I guess, in this part of the world where it's all sand and desert. These beautiful paradise garden. So the text reads, Yahweh God, once upon a time, Yahweh God planted a garden in Eden, in this place of delight. In the east, because all life comes from the east, it's where the sun rises. And there he put the human being whom he'd formed. Out of the ground, Yahweh God made to grow every tree that's pleasant to look at and good for food. The tree of life also was in the middle of the garden. This extraordinary tree that'll come back in the story. And another tree, the tree of the knowledge of good and evil. So in the middle of this orchard, this walled paradise, there are these two trees. Tree of life and the tree of good and evil. Then the author talks about the life arteries, all the rivers, the great rivers of the north, south, east and west, so obviously there are four, that come out of the water of paradise. They're flowing out of this paradise to water the whole world. The text reads, a river is flowing from Eden to water the garden, and from there it divides and becomes four branches. This is not geography, this is story. It's beautiful though. The name of the first branch, river, is Pishon. It is the one that flows around the whole land of Havilah. And Havilah is southwest Arabia, where there's gold, and the gold of that land is good. Delium and onyx stone are there from their trade. That's where they used to get these precious stones from the southern western part of the Arabian Peninsula. So that's the first river. The name of the second river is Gihon. That's the Nile in Egypt. It's the one that flows around the whole land of Cush. We might say Sudan. The name of the third river is Tigris, which flows east of Assyria. And the fourth river, which is called the Great River throughout the Bible, is the Euphrates. So the Tigris and the Euphrates water Iraq, let's call it. I dug this up and it may be of interest to you if I can talk about it intelligently and briefly. This is a drawing from the 17th century BC from a place called Mari. And if you look at it, there are two trees here. Are our authors drawing on this story, or are our authors and this very ancient story drawing on other stories? So the stories are circulating through the land. So there are two trees. Here we have cherubim on both sides, and they were the, in Iran particularly, they were the guarding the Temenos, the sacred sanctuary, to threaten anyone who dared enter the sanctuary, and the priest was allowed in. Anyone else who dared, well, they were too scared to do it. I mean, terrible, these creatures that have got all the wings of an eagle and the body of a lion and so on. So these creatures, that's the cherubim. This is Ishtar, goddess, and there's the lion. So she's the hunter goddess in Mari, way back. And it's hard to see, but there, from each of these, from the sanctuary, there are four streams coming out. So it's almost impossible not to believe that this very ancient, so we're 1,200 years before the book of Genesis here, these ancient stories have been going around all over the Middle East. Yahweh God, says our author, took the human being, and we're not talking about male and female yet, we're just talking about us, humanity, took the human being and settled the human being in the Garden of Eden to till it and care for it. Isaiah chapter 51, drawing on this, reads, Yahweh has pity on Zion, has pity on all her ruins, turns her desolation into an Eden, her wasteland into the Garden of Yahweh. Joy and gladness shall be found in her, thanksgiving and the sound of music, preparing in hope for the miraculous return across the desert to the promised land. Creaturely existence demands of its essence a relationship of receptivity to the Creator. Break the link with the Creator and creation collapses. And now we move into a second person address. This has all been objective. Now there's an address. God is communicating to us. Yahweh God commanded the human being, you may freely eat of every tree of the garden, but from the tree of the knowledge of good and evil you are not to eat. For, and listen to the threat, a threat which God doesn't carry out. God keeps giving in all the time to us. The threat is, on the day you eat it, you'll die. In other words, it's poisonous. It's going to kill you if this tree, the fruit of this tree, won't bring you life. On the contrary, it'll bring you death immediately. Look at the apocalypse, the end of the apocalypse. He showed me a river of the water of life, bright as crystal, issuing from the throne of God and the Lamb. In the middle of the city square, and also on either side of the river, the tree of life, with its 12 kinds of fruit, yielding its fruit each month. And the leaves of the tree were for the healing of the nations. So this is the orchard again, the paradise. The tree of the knowledge of good and evil These are suggestions as to what that could mean. One, the capacity to discern what's useful and avoid what's harmful, good and evil. Discerning. The capacity to discern what's morally good and what's morally evil. The knowledge of good and evil could encompass that. The capacity to know everything, so good and evil is the whole range from one to the other. The capacity to know everything, the way God knows everything. And more dangerous of all, the capacity to make up one's own mind as to what is good and what is evil without reference to God. We don't need God. We're independent, we're intelligent, we can work out what's good and evil. We don't need God to do this. We're going to see that's very close to the heart of this story. Then the authors talk about the complementarity, it's the first time this has come, the interdependence and the equality of man and woman. The text reads, Yahweh God said, it's not good for the human being to be alone. I will make for the human being a helper who will face him. This is difficult because it's almost impossible for us not to try and imagine this. It's an intellectual statement, not an imaginary one. And it's also a problem. We put sequence into this. This is not sequential. This is looking at different aspects of the human existence. And now it's looking at this one, which is obvious. So Yahweh God formed from the ground all the... We've read it all in chapter 1, but forget chapter 1. This is a different story. Formed from the ground all the animals of the field and all birds of the heavens, and he brought them to the human being to see what he would call them, and whatever the human being called the living beings, that was their name. This is control, dominance, power. The human being gave their names to all the livestock, all the birds of the heavens, and all the animals of the field. But for the human being, no helper who will face him was found. So, Yahweh God caused a deep sleep to fall on the human being so that this he and him is a problem, but that's an English problem, I'll just keep it going. The human being slept. Now, God doesn't create this helper. Help's already there. God has created humanity, and there's humanity. What God does in this story is, he takes the rib and immediately closes up the flesh again. And Yahweh God made the rib. Why rib? Well, here's the why. In Sumerian, not in Hebrew, but in Sumerian, from over the Mesopotamian area, in Sumerian, it's a play on the word for a woman giving birth. So the origins of the story, there's a pun here. It doesn't work in Hebrew and certainly doesn't work in English. But they've chosen the word rib for this reason. The rib that he'd taken from the human being into a woman and brought her to the man. So you've got, not sequentially, but you've got humanity. It's just one thing. No, it's not. They're telling us humanity is actually two things that are cut down the middle and that need each other to be whole, taken from. And the man said, these are the first words used in the Bible of a man speaking back to God. It sounds wonderful in Hebrew. I'll just give you the first word. Here's Adam, and all the animals are coming, and he names them all, but he's not satisfied with anything. That's not going to help. Then Eve appears, and Adam says, "Zut!" Work out that for yourselves. It's a cry of it. He thinks, well, now you're talking. Here's something. This one at last is bone of my bones and flesh of my flesh. So let's call her Isha, because she comes from Ish. This is the first time Isha and Ish have been used. Adam has been talked about humanity. Now you've suddenly got Ish and Isha, man, woman, gender. Therefore, our authors can't resist putting this in. It's just an aside, really. Therefore, an Ish leaves his father and mother and stays attached to his Isha, and they become one flesh. That's the aside, and the text goes on. Both of them were naked. We'll come back to this. The Hebrew is arom. Both were naked, the man and his wife, and they were unashamed. So there's a, so far, a lovely innocence here. It's fine to be who you are, so they are. And there's God, and there's Adam and Eve. I'm reading this to you rather reluctantly, but it's because I don't understand it, basically. I haven't studied it properly, and if you have, I'd love to hear about it later. This is from Plato, who was maybe 50 years late after this writing we're doing, so it's about the same period. And it's from his Symposium, and the text is there if you want it. And this was his description, imagined description, of humanity, and you'll see some parallels with our text. The primeval man, says Plato, was round, his back and sides forming a circle, and he had four hands and four feet, one head with two faces, looking opposite ways, set on a round neck and precisely alike. Also four ears and two privy members and the remainder to correspond. He could walk upright as men now do, backward or forward as he pleased. And he could also roll over and over at a great pace, turning on his four hands and four feet, eight in all, like tumblers going over and over with their legs in the air. This was when he wanted to run fast. He aspired against the gods. Ah. He aspired against the gods, but Zeus sliced him in two. And after the division, the two parts of man, mankind, each desiring his other half, came together and throwing their arms around one another, entwined in mutual embraces, longing to grow into one. The desire of one another which is implanted in us, reuniting our original nature, making one of two and healing the state of man. I'll let you make of that what you will. But there is some kind of a parallel here. So, the conclusions to part one. What have we learned from this story? Human beings come from the dust, but live because of the divine spirit. We've learnt, or the story has told us, that human beings are to live in caring control of the animal world and in mutual interdependence with the soil, with the Adama. We've learnt that human beings are to live in dialogue with God and in dependence on God's word, the command. God alerting us to what we can't eat because it will kill us. It's not good for us. God deciding that and letting us know, of course, in the Torah, as they saw it. And human beings are man and woman facing each other in equality and in delight.